Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. Today I'm talking with filmmaker and podcaster Kelsey Snelling about her new podcast, Camp Shame, which exposes the troubling history of a notorious weight loss camp. We get into the effects of deprivation and starvation, the cult-like nature of the camp, how it weathered its many scandals, whether it's really possible to run a camp for larger-bodied kids that can be weight-inclusive or ethical, how she made the podcast, and lots more. And just a heads up that we go into a little bit of detail about the disordered eating and dieting behaviors that went on at the camp. We also touch on the self-harm and sexual abuse that happened there. Kelsey did a really great job of investigating all the sordid stories and including many different people's perspectives on the camp, from former campers to counselors and staff to lifers who'd done it all. And I think this conversation has a lot of relevance for anyone who's done any kind of group diet program or even maybe just dieted in general. I can't wait to share the interview with you in just a moment. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you like this podcast, I think you'll love my newest book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who are also multi-time fan-favorite guests on this podcast. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and wellness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Kelsey Snelling. I would love to hear about your personal history with diet and wellness culture.
Sure. I think I come from actually a pretty healthy diet culture background, if that makes sense. I mean, my parents, looking back, were really good about not having magazines in the house, not really watching any kind of like entertainment media. My parents were never on diets. It was never really something that was discussed in our household. However, I still succumbed to a lot of habits of diet culture, which I think is interesting and just speaks to the power of our culture. When I was in maybe middle school, high school, of course, I started dieting, which is just insane because I was a scrawny little thing and was convinced that I needed to lose weight. And the thing that's really kind of scary looking back at that time in my life is I was actually an undiagnosed diabetic. Yeah, I was born with this rare form of diabetes called MODY. And didn't know it until I was actually 30, 31 years old. So, you know, I'm in middle school. I already don't really know how to take care of myself or how to feed myself properly. It's the 90s. It's the early 2000s. I'm eating Lucky Charms for breakfast. And then, of course, I'm crashing halfway through the day. And then I'm binging on more food. And then I'm trying to restrict because I think I need to lose weight. And then I'm binging again later at night. So I had this really toxic relationship with food and didn't even realize it for many, many, many years, well into and out of college. And I would say probably in my late 20s is when I started to realize that my habits were not healthy and there were probably some psychological and physiological things going on there. And that's when I really started to get into the anti-diet space and finally got diagnosed with this form of diabetes. And I feel like since then I have been on, you know, a much healthier path, but it took a really long time to get there.
Tell me about MODY. I would love to hear more about that because it is such a rare condition.
Yeah, so MODY stands for Mature Onset Diabetes of the Young, which I think is a hilarious acronym. Like, what? It sounds like some like medieval disease. Your body is essentially, it still produces insulin, but it doesn't produce quite enough. And so it's not really like type 2 because type 2 is insulin resistance and I don't have that. It's not really like type 1 because in type 1, you are required to be on insulin. You don't produce your own insulin. It's kind of like a weird in between. And you have to get a genetic test for this condition to prove that you have this condition. And I think it's something like 2% of diabetics are diagnosed with MODY, although I do think it's underdiagnosed, so I will say that, but it's pretty rare.
And so how did you didn't know you had it, but you were probably experiencing symptoms of it? Like, it sounds like the crashing and the response to sugar maybe was a clue.
Oh, absolutely. Ever since I was a little kid, I'm talking like 4 years old, I have a memory of when I was not even in kindergarten yet of eating a full bag of Hershey Kisses at my friend's house. Like, we had gone with her mom to the gas station. We picked up this bag of Hershey Kisses. My friend Kelly, she had two Hershey Kisses and she was good. And I had the rest of the bag. And again, I was like 4 years old. I remember being in like fifth, sixth grade and eating an entire frozen cheesecake that I found in my parents' basement freezer, like a 10-inch cheesecake, things that like normal people should not be able to do. So I really had this fixation with sugar for a long time. And my dad is diabetic and his dad was diabetic. We regularly were going to doctors to do tests and to see if I also had diabetes. The thing about the 90s and the 2000s is really the only way that they would test for diabetes at that time is they would take your fasting blood sugar in the morning. And my fasting blood sugar was always fine. So they were like, you don't have diabetes, you're good. And it wasn't until I was out of college that I took that awful, the glucose tolerance test where they give you like that nasty syrup and they make you drink it every 2 hours and they see how your body responds to it. During that test, this is when I was 21, the doctors were like, no, girl, you're diabetic. You are very diabetic, the way that you're spiking, and then it takes a while for your levels to come back down. So they diagnosed me as a type 2 diabetic. So I was on metformin for all of my 20s. And it was really unusual because, you know, every time you go to a new doctor, like, you know, say you go to the dermatologist and they want your entire medical history, right? Every time you go to a new doctor, I was constantly having to tell these doctors I'm a type 2 diabetic. And it was always met with a lot of skepticism because typically with type 2 diabetes, you know, that occurs in people who are in their 40s, maybe even later, maybe they're not active. And I just didn't fit any of those criteria. So there was a lot of suspicion around it, but I was like, I don't know, this is the diagnosis. I guess that's what I have. I have all these symptoms. And then when I was 30, 31, I found this amazing doctor. I have to shout out Penn Medicine in Philadelphia because she diagnosed me with MODY. She was like, you had type 2 symptoms when you were too young to be having those symptoms. It sounds like it runs in your family. It sounds like your dad has the same thing. Because my dad was the same way, where when he was a kid, he just couldn't stop eating sugar. He eventually was put on insulin, but his pancreas still made a little bit of insulin. And so, like, is he type 1? Is he type 2? We weren't sure. So yeah, I did. I think it was like a saliva test. They looked at the gene. They were like, yep, you and your whole family probably all have the same thing. It's called MODY.
That sounds like your specific way of relating to sugar was very much explained by this. It's interesting, too, that it sounds like you weren't particularly like shamed or made to go on a diet or something because of this relationship with sugar, which I feel like happens for a lot of people who, for whatever reason, might be eating large quantities of sugar.
Right. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, I was a thin kid. So even though I had this really toxic relationship with food and eating, and the other side of that, too, is I was eating all this sugar. I wasn't really eating any real food. Like, to this day, I don't really like food. I really only want to eat dessert. So, you know, you could see for like a really active growing kid, that could be a problem. But because I was thin, nobody ever flagged it.
That's like the interesting flip side of weight stigma, right? Mostly affects people in larger bodies, and like the higher up the spectrum you go, there's more weight stigma, but it also affects thinner people too in these weird ways and sort of roundabout ways. Well, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how you got into this work you do now. You're a filmmaker and you just made a podcast called Camp Shame with an M that is about Camp Shane with an N. It was a famous long-running weight loss camp and a very problematic one, as you detail in your show. But you ended up being a counselor at Camp Shane in college, right? Or just out of college. So I'm curious, like, how you got involved with that and how it sort of affected your relationship with food and your body from there.
So when I was a preteen and a teen and in high school and in college, I became really engrossed with what we now would probably call the body positivity movement. You know, I had had all these issues with food and body image when I was younger. When I was a freshman in college, I stumbled upon this book called The Body Project by Joan Jacobs Brumberg. And I believe she was a professor at Cornell, and I actually attended Ithaca College in the same town. And this book really blew me away because what she did is she basically cataloged a bunch of journals from Victorian era girls and women. And she kind of annotated when these girls were describing body image issues and weight loss and, you know, how they were tracking the food that they ate. And it was really mind-blowing to me because when I was in high school, all of my friends were very thin. I was really skinny as a kid, but after puberty, I wouldn't really say I got bigger. I mean, I was muscular. I was really active. I wasn't super scrawny like the rest of my friends were. And I had internalized this at the time and thought like, wow, I really felt like for a long time I was the only person who was dealing with these body image issues. You know, this was really before YouTube. It was way before social media. No one was really talking about this stuff. I felt like everyone was just kind of secretly dieting and you weren't supposed to discuss it with your friends. So when I found this book, it really like blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is so much bigger than me. This is an issue that goes way back to before, well before I was born. And that was really the first time that I realized that and like was able to acknowledge that the problem wasn't with me and my relationship with food. The problem was much deeper than that. And that kind of sent me on this mission where, you know, I just started reading as many books as I could and watching as many documentaries as I could about the topic. And so by the time I was a junior in college, the summer between my junior and senior year, my sister had sent me this summer job opportunity from a place called Camp Shane. So my sister and I were both interested in working at a summer camp. We had never been camp counselors before. We both really love being outside. We think kids are hilarious. So we signed up. We were like, why not? It kind of ties everything together that I had always been interested in. So June 2011, we show up at Camp Shane for counselor orientation, and what a summer it was. It was not anything like we were anticipating.
Yeah. So what were you expecting it to be and what was the actual reality?
So at the time, back in 2011, if you were to Google Camp Shane, you would have found this really colorful website that advertised all kinds of wild activities. There's paintball, there's go-karts, there's, you know, a lake and a banana boat, and you see these kids on a rope course and everybody's having fun. And it was a 9-week program for the kids. So it's a sleepaway camp, an overnight camp. It really seemed like a cool opportunity to just like get in there and make some friends and meet some cool campers and, you know, make some friendship bracelets. Why not? So we were really, really excited about it. And there were also at the time a lot of media pieces about Camp Shane. They were featured on Tyra Banks, on the Dr. Oz show, on the Oprah Winfrey show. And everyone just made it seem like it was this really empowering place for kids where they were free from the bullies. They were encouraged to be active and find activity that they loved. They were being helped nutritionally along the way and kind of learning all the things that I wish I had known as a kid, you know, like don't eat a 10-inch cheesecake. That's going to make you crash later in the day. So it just really seemed like a wonderful place. And that's 100% what we were expecting. We thought that we would be going in and helping kids develop their body image. It doesn't make sense now when I look back, but at the time we thought that there was a much more body positive angle to the whole thing and to the programming.
From what you say in the podcast too, it sounds like that comes from the founder, right? The woman who founded the camp seemed to have that angle somewhat in the sense of like wanting to create a safe space for kids in larger bodies to feel good about themselves, to not feel like they're being picked last all the time for sports, to like be able to have relationships, you know? And so that aspect of it seemed, I can see why you would assume maybe that there was a little more body positivity than there actually was.
Right, right. And it, you know, at the time too, I think that's what was selling. There was a big push toward body positivity around that time. And I think Camp Shane was trying to capitalize on that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm a registered dietitian, as you know. And when I was in school in my training and sort of the final stages, my dietetic internship was right around the same time. And I remember there were rotations available at Camp Shane for dietitians. And I didn't do it, but I think that some people in my cohort did. And
what?
Yeah, there were like dietetic interns coming from, you know, New York City schools. I mean, I'm so curious. We'll talk more about this soon, but like, you know, the leading the nutrition groups and stuff like that. Like, I wonder how much these interns who were not yet credentialed and qualified were sort of involved in doing the work that should have been done by a registered dietitian.
Right. Happy to talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but before we do, I would just love to hear more about your experience there and sort of what you saw. Like, what was the reality of this camp and what did it do to the kids' relationships with food and their bodies?
Well, immediately when I arrived, I realized very quickly that things were not quite as advertised. All of the counselors had to show up about a week and a half early, depending on your role, to essentially set up the camp. We were cleaning, we were hauling mattresses back and forth, we were sweeping, you know, things that a maintenance team really should have been doing. And there wasn't any training, which I found very, very odd. You know, we would do some icebreakers. I think, did a couple of like role playing, what to do if there's conflict between your campers. But there was absolutely nothing specific to the content and the mission of the camp. So we were not taught to identify disordered eating. We were not even really taught what the nutritional philosophy was supposed to be at camp. To this day, I'm not really sure what their approach specifically was, other than just, you know, calorie restriction and extreme deficit. So there was a lot of information that was missing from that orientation. We didn't really get any education on what these kids might be dealing with. A lot of them are really troubled and traumatized and, you know, they're bullied at school and they have these issues with their parents who are constantly berating them about their weight. None of that was explained to us or made clear to us, or, you know, we weren't prepared for that in any way. So, you know, that was a problem. And then, of course, as counselors, we were going to the cafeteria every day and we're being fed these meals that are insane. I mean, no human would classify what we ate at Camp Shane as a meal. I mean, my most specific memory is we were given 2 French toast sticks at breakfast.
Oh, jeez.
Those little spongy, like, bready cinnamon it was bizarre. And I kind of figured, okay, it's orientation. Once the campers get here, things will get better. And that was not the case. So right out of the gate, there were issues. And then once the campers arrived, day one, it was actually my birthday, the day that all these campers showed up. I turned 21 that day. And what a birthday it was. It was pouring rain. The kids were miserable. They were crying. You know, a couple of kids were excited because they were return campers and they were happy to see some of their friends. But for the majority of my campers, there was a lot of emotion, a lot of negative emotion, a lot of crying, not wanting their parents to leave them behind. And again, I had never been a camp counselor. So I was like, you know what? 9 weeks is a long time. I get it. The kids are upset. And then once everybody kind of settled in, I started to hear these stories about like, oh, I've been coming here for 3 years and they don't feed you and all the counselors are really mean and they yell at you. And I was kind of starting to piece together that like this was more than just homesickness. And I had the 13-year-old girls. So, you know, they're not super young. They're aware of what's going on. So I trusted what they were telling me. And things really just, as the summer went on, got worse and worse and worse. And it's crazy because sometimes I think about things that happened at camp. I feel like it was years that I was at this summer camp. And then I go back in my journal and I'm like, holy shit, that happened on day three. That's crazy. And really the way that I would describe the counselor experience is just constant, constant chaos with no direction and with no support. So again, these kids are coming in with some of them already very serious issues around food, around self-worth, around relationships. And I mean, it seemed like every 20 minutes there was a camper, you know, having a breakdown and crying because they hated their bodies and they wanted to lose more weight. And I only lost pounds this week and I should have lost pounds. Again, these are 13-year-old kids. Really, really disturbing stuff. And, you know, eventually it kind of escalated. Campers were threatening to cut themselves. Campers were threatening suicide. And, you know, these are 13-year-old kids. And I understand not all of this was legitimate. Some of this probably was for attention. But I was a 21-year-old child and I wasn't trained to know the difference between what is a real threat and what is not a real threat. There was no system in place for like, who do we report this to? What happens? How does this type of thing escalate? It was kind of just us counselors running around shouting to, you know, various higher ups, like, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem. And then they would kind of nod their heads and they would move on with the day. So it really came to a point where I felt, and I know a lot of other counselors felt, like the actual literal lives of these kids were in our hands and we were not equipped to handle that. So it was, I really don't like to use the word traumatizing. I think that word gets overused a lot. But in this case, it was extremely traumatizing. And when I left camp at the end of the summer, I was really messed up after that experience. I was anxious and afraid to go in public for many months. I started my senior year of college at the end of that summer. And I remember going a couple of weeks early thinking like, oh, you know, I'll hang out with my friends. We'll get drinks. I'm finally 21. We'll kick off the senior year right. And I was unable to leave the house many times before nightfall. I would only go out when it was dark. And I think part of that was that I had developed a lot of self-consciousness around my body and the way that I looked while I was at camp. And I think another part of that was just an emotional shutdown where I had been in this high-stakes situation for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And it just got to a point where, like, I didn't have an emotional response to anything anymore. And I was kind of self-conscious about being around other people because, you know, normally where I would laugh, I didn't feel compelled to laugh. When someone would tell me something sad, I didn't feel compelled to cry. I just kind of felt like a sociopath after that summer.
It sounds like you numbed out in response to all that pain that you saw around you, which is understandable and like such a common experience, I think. I wonder how much of also like what you experienced and what the kids experienced, you know, the sort of behavioral volatility and stuff that they were going through and the emotional shutdownness and sort of agoraphobia, I guess, a little bit of what you were going through was like related to the starvation, the deprivation, because you mentioned in the podcast that kids were so starved and deprived that they were like sneaking in food. There's a black market in food, right? They would like order food to a hole in the fence, have it, you know, smuggled in, and black market candy being eaten in the toilets and stuff like that. Like, this is the behavior of desperate people, right? And the kinds of portions and weeks of calorie deprivation that you talked about in the podcast was like just staggering to me, you know, and made me think of things like the Minnesota starvation experiment, which is very old at this point, but it's kind of like one of the only real studies on starvation that we have, because now that kind of study would never get approved by an institutional review board, right? But at the time they were like doing it for the war effort. And so they were able to subject people to what they called semi-starvation, which was really drastic. And we now can see that that level of calorie deprivation, which is like what gets recommended on popular diets, right? It's like seen as, oh, this is sort of a light diet or whatever, but it was taking away half of their energy, half of their necessary calories. And these men like totally went bonkers too, right? Somebody, I think he tried to chop his hand off or something like that. Like, it was just like wild, wild stuff. The mental and physical toll that it took on people was extreme.
Oh yeah, for sure. And that was certainly the case with the campers as well. I think that's why everything felt so high stakes. You know, the highs were higher and the lows were lower. And I think that's where a lot of like the compulsion to self-harm came from. And I do think that's where a lot of the, for lack of a better term, drama stemmed from, was that these kids were not being fed. And the other thing about Camp Shane that I think is really strange and really will give you insight into kind of like how psychologically damaging it is. There are a lot of terrible things happening, right? Kids are being starved. Kids develop this hatred of their bodies. Kids are becoming really competitive about weight loss. They're becoming competitive about, you know, the dating and the opportunities there at Camp Shane. You would wake up in the morning and there would be a camper crying and talking about how she wanted to purge because, you know, she ate a potato chip. And then you hear this announcement over the loudspeaker that's like, there's a parade after lunch. And then everybody's like cheering because there's going to be a parade. And then you hear that like a camper is cutting and no one is doing anything about it. But then like there's a bonfire happen. Like, it's really a mind fuck when you're there. And it's constant, minute after minute, day after day after day. And I know for me and for a lot of the people that I interviewed, when you leave Camp Shane at the end of the summer, you kind of feel like it was a fever dream. You're like, what the hell was that? Once you're removed from it, you're like, oh my God, was that even real? And I think that that kind of scared a lot of people into silence. I think we all sort of gaslit ourselves into being like, was it that bad? Like, am I crazy? Because I look back at the pictures and I see these pictures of, you know, these floats and these costumes and people doing dances and everybody's playing soccer and they're cheering. But my actual memories are so much darker than that. And so that was really the catalyst for me starting to do this investigation and do this research, is I wanted to know, am I crazy? Was my experience unique? Or did other people see what I saw?
And what did you find?
Well, turns out I'm not crazy. And what I found is that things were much worse than I had even experienced. As I mentioned, you know, I saw a lot of disordered eating and I saw a lot of self-loathing and I saw that side of things at Camp Shane for sure. But as I started interviewing more and more people, I learned that it was much more malicious than that. In my reporting and my interviewing, at this point, I've talked to probably maybe 250 people, just because since the release of the podcast, I've been getting so many additional messages and I've been talking to so many more people. And the stories that just keep coming out, I mean, they shouldn't surprise me at this point, but they continue to surprise me. you know, stories about, oh, in the 90s, our snack was a Diet Coke or it was an ice cube with Splenda. Absolutely terrible. Or, you know, you hear these stories of like the skinny kids that got sent to camp because they knew they would that they would be the most popular. And now they're put on this diet and they're losing weight. And then all kinds of sexual assaults going on between campers, but also between counselors and campers. I mean, all kinds of issues came out of this camp and stemmed from the fact that kids had low self-worth. They had low self-esteem oftentimes. And that was just reinforced at camp. It was reinforced that the smaller your body is, the more respect you get, the more applause you get, the more valuable you are.
Yeah. You know, when I heard some of those stories of sexual abuse and assault, I think it was Seth maybe who had sort of the biggest story around that and just described this horrible abuse he endured from a counselor. It made me think about the cults that break down their members' self-esteem by starving them, you know, and like the way that people who are sort of seeking something, right, or not feeling good about themselves can be lured into these like high demand places and, you know, these additional restrictions put on them where they're not eating enough, they're not in contact with the outside world. Because that's the other thing about Camp Shane, too, is like they restricted people's, like kids' access to their parents, right? They weren't able to call out unless they were being supervised by a counselor or monitored for like 5-minute phone calls. And if they said anything negative about the camp, the counselor was trained to hang up the phone. It's just, it really does feel in some ways very cult-like and very just a breeding ground for that kind of abuse. Did you experience that as well?
Totally. I had an interesting perspective at Camp Shane because I came in as kind of an outsider. Like I was only there for one summer. I didn't really know anything about camp before I arrived. A lot of the people at Camp Shane are what we call lifers. So you'll hear us talk about that in the podcast where you go as a camper, you're a return camper year after year, you become a counselor. You know, there are people who were at Camp Shane for 10 plus years. So for me as an outsider, I do remember feeling kind of like, you know, I'm not really part of this in a way. I felt much more like an observer. As I started to produce this podcast with my production team, that cult topic came up a number of times, and I actually hadn't really thought about it before. You know, as I was talking to people about their stories, my producers, once in a while, they'd be like, you know, you and these other Shaners, you're talking about these stories as if like this is a hilarious story, but like, you know, that's really screwed up, right? And I'd be like, yeah, I know it's screwed up, but it's also like when you're at camp, it doesn't feel that way. And I kind of started to piece together like, this is very much like a cult where when you're in it, you're not really thinking about how weird it is to the outside world. And then when other people come in with a fresh set of eyes, they're the ones who make you realize, you know, this is not normal. This is not a normal place.
Yeah, it's so fucked up and it's so insidious, it sounds like. Because, I mean, I'm curious, the lifers that you interviewed, how they experienced that, how they were able to sort of keep coming back year after year. Because, you know, it sounds like some of the kids were like dreading it and felt the sort of horror of the situation. They were like very aware of that or just knew that they didn't want to be there and that something felt off. And then other people maybe were able to suppress that somehow or didn't get that feeling because maybe their experience was different or for whatever reason, I'm not sure. But I'm curious about that. Sort of what made lifers able to just stick it out?
I kind of get chills sometimes when I talk about this because this is the part that I think is so emotional. Because a lot of these lifers were fully aware that this was not enough food to live off of. They were fully aware that camp was not being run properly and the supervision was not as it should have been. And there was negligence abounding and the equipment was all broken. Like they knew this. But these are people who are in higher weight bodies who in the outside world are completely ostracized. They're not getting asked on dates. Their parents are embarrassed to have a bigger kid. They just don't feel like they belong. They feel like they can't be themselves. And they want so badly for this camp to be all that they want it to be, that they're willing to overlook all of those red flags. And that to me is so heartbreaking. And that's a big part of what made camp so dangerous, is they knew they could be negligent. They fully were aware that they did not have to put much effort into the camp, much money into the camp, and that people would still come back, because that's how desperate people are to fit in.
Yeah, that is profound and so sad, and just, I think, really speaks to the toll that weight stigma has on people and anti-fat bias, you know, has on our society. Like, something like that. And we haven't even gotten into all the nitty-gritty details of like lack of supervision or the lack of equipment and the safety issues and all of that stuff, which just, like, I mean, it is madness. It is just
pretty bad.
Yeah, it's really bad to, you know, go through all that, to endure that, to be aware of that, especially as they're growing up, right? Because these campers would go from kids to adolescents to, in some cases, adults who would come back and work there. To be in a growing awareness like that of all the things that are so messed up and not right about this place, and to still choose to come back because it's better than the alternative, is just heartbreaking.
It's so sad. And transparently, when I started this project, I went into it fully with the expectation that this was an expose, that I was going to bring this camp down, that I was going to reveal everything. And the more that I interviewed, it weirdly became this love letter to Camp Shane, because the more people that I talked to, the more I realized, like, this really was a meaningful place to so many people. And again, I was coming in as an outsider. I was only really seeing how screwed up it was from that lens. But the more that I interviewed these lifers, especially, the more that I understood why people continued to go back. And I actually had this really profound moment when I was interviewing. So shout out to Nelson. Nelson was a lifer at camp. He started as a camper. His mom was a camp nurse. He became a counselor. He was there for years. And Nelson and I worked together in 2011. I didn't talk too much to the boys at camp. I kind of stayed away from boys camp. They were kind of insane. I do know Nelson, you know, he was super gregarious and he was always down for anything. He was a counselor at the time that I was there. He was always like the first one to like dress up or like lead a team, like just this like larger than life personality. And during my interviewing, I talked to Carl Evans, who was also a lifer, camper turned counselor. And Carl was the one who told me that Nelson had actually been going to camp since before my time. When I was a counselor there, I had no idea what anybody's history was. But when I talked to Carl, he was like, oh, yeah, Nelson was one of my campers. Like, he'd been going to camp for years. And Carl told me that when Nelson first came to camp, he was shy, he was reserved, he was quiet. And that made me, like, so emotional. I could see that, like, camp is the place where, like, he was his best self. And that was an aha moment for me, where I was like, okay, I get it. Camp really does transform people, sometimes in not so great ways. But when you are in this world where your body is removed from the equation, you can really be yourself and you can really be confident. And that was a really beautiful thing about Camp Shane. And again, that's why people were so drawn to it and they went back year after year.
Yeah. And why it must be so, like, confusing and hard for people to make sense of it now, so many years later, right? When they're, you know, reflecting back on it, because it was a pivotal time in so many people's lives. It gave them so much. And yet all of that was wrapped up with so much bad stuff, so many darker things that they probably are still having to sift through now.
Exactly. And a lot of people that I've spoken with also, I think if I had talked to them 10 years ago, they would have said, oh, Camp Shane was the greatest experience of my life. But now that they do have some distance, they can look back and they can say, yeah, it was great because I had my first boyfriend. It was great because I made good friends. It was great because I remember this fun activity. But they're better able to parse it now and realize that, you know, if those things were removed, this would have been a horrific experience.
Mm-hmm. The good stuff was enough to keep people coming back and keep their parents sending them there and keep it from being totally exposed much sooner, it sounds like. I'm curious how the camp was able to pull the wool over so many people's eyes, right? Because there was just such fraud really going on between what they promised and what they delivered. And even, you know, in some of the, sounds like in later years, there was even more promises of greater stakes. Like, we have a doctor on staff that can take care of all your child's medical needs. And the reality of that was like, no, there was no doctor. There was barely even a nurse there. How did that continue for as long as it did? And sort of with heightening levels of promises not being delivered.
It's incredible to me. And one of the core questions of this project for me was, how did this place stay open for so long? First of all, David Ettenberg, the owner of Camp Shane, is not a charming or convincing person. This is not a story about a con man who, you know, he swept people off their feet and he could, whatever the phrase is.
Yeah, this wasn't a charismatic leader that was, you know, getting people to bend to his will or whatever, or go along with some massive, like, vision that he had.
He was not that at all, at all. And still, parents believed this man. It's absurd to me. I truly believe that the reason this camp was in operation for as long as it was is solely because of this desperation around weight loss. I think, of course, a part of it is kids wanted to go back year after year and see their friends, and maybe they didn't tell their parents the whole story because, you know, they didn't want their parents to withhold them from the camp experience. But I really think a bigger part of it is a lot of these parents were kind of absentee parents. This is a camp for pretty wealthy kids who come from wealthy families. And of course, that's not true of everyone. There were some great parents who just didn't know what to do. They saw their kids struggling and they thought this was an answer. And, you know, sure, I'll do anything to help my kid. But I would say a lot of the parents were the ones who caused body issues in their kids. A lot of these parents were sending their thin children to Camp Shane. A lot of these parents were telling their kids, you know, you better lose weight for your bat mitzvah or your bar mitzvah. I mean, we had a ton of 12 and 13 year olds at this camp for that reason. And I think that people are just really willing to turn a blind eye. They're like, you know what? You say the ropes have been eaten through by rats. Okay, you're losing weight. It's fine. Or, oh, the quote unquote nurse gave you broth when you broke your rib. It's fine. You still lost pounds. Remember how happy you were when you came home and you could fit in all these clothes? Really, it has to be that. Because if this was any other type of camp, parents would have pulled their kids immediately. They would have called the police. They would have alerted the media. Camp would have been shut down right away. And we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, so it was this bigger promise of weight loss and like what that would mean for the kid and in some cases the family, right? Like the sort of parents that were felt like their kid was a reflection on them and that their child needed to lose weight in order to reflect better on them or whatever. And yeah, like you said, not all parents were like that. And there were some, I mean, it was interesting to hear that some of the kids had actually convinced their parents to let them go, that like the kids were the driving force, which also speaks to like how insidious weight stigma is and diet culture, you know, really hooks kids at a young age in some cases and makes them think that they would need something like that. Or, you know, the experiences of stigma that they've had made them feel that they need a place like that. It does make a lot of sense that, you know, without the diet culture piece, a lot of that stuff would probably have come to light earlier and resulted in the camp not existing much earlier than it shut down.
Right. And the other thing that is really fascinating to me is that David was not the only adult at this camp. There were plenty of adults there through the years. And some of those adults that I've spoken with still don't believe anything was wrong, which is really interesting. I think there's a number of things that contributed to this camp being in operation for as long as it was. And until things got so, so bad that literally a state investigation was open against them, they continued business as usual.
It's terrifying as a parent to think about that and think about places you could send your kid. I mean, I would never in a million years send my children to weight loss camp, any sort of camp, right? It's a fun activity for the summer and, you know, something to do while school's out. It's kind of scary to think, like, how do you really know and how do you really choose? Because this camp was being inspected, you know, on a regular basis, I assume. Like, camps, they at least renew every year, is my understanding. I know, at least in my state. I don't know about New York where they were based. Or no, they were in Connecticut, right?
They were in New York. They moved to Connecticut for the last couple of years. Yeah.
That's right. How did that go on, you know?
Right. Well, I did pull a number of inspection reports through the years, and Camp Shane did not have the most outstanding grade on many of those reports. The thing with summer camps is there really are not a lot of laws around how they're run, who is operating them. I think it's something like only 13 states require background checks for their staff. I mean, Camp Shane obviously was not doing that. I think Simon tried. I think he had his staff, from what I've heard, like Google people. But again, a lot of this is before social media. So it's like, what are you even going to find on Google? There's just really not a lot of regulation, and it varies. Those regulations do vary state to state, sometimes city to city. And as a parent, I mean, you don't have time to investigate every single summer camp. That, you know, you just assume it's a summer camp. It's past inspection. The staff are safe people for my kid to be around. Why would you think otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I have signed my daughter up for things in retrospect, been like, oh, I wonder if there's any sort of reports on this place, and looked into it and been like,
right. What's so sad, too, is like, I really don't mean for this project to be anti-summer camp. I think especially in the age of helicopter parenting, summer camp is a wonderful thing for kids to experience, especially for kids like Shainer's who come from these wealthier families. A lot of them grew up in the city. And, you know, you get to be outside in the woods and you're in a cabin and there's bugs and you're learning all of this independence and all of this responsibility and you're forming relationships. And I think all of that is so crucial to development. I just wish that it was a much safer environment.
I think the original promise of Selma, who was the founder of the camp, of like creating a safe space for kids, you know, the part of it that was sort of in line with body positivity or fat acceptance, right? Because there were other parts of her original vision that were very much diet culture. It was very ensconced in diet culture from the beginning. But like that vision of giving kids a safe place to be themselves and to be kids and enjoy all the things that childhood should bring if you're not being stigmatized for whatever aspect of your identity, like that part of it, I wish there was a camp like that, you know, that could give kids the opportunity to like feel good about themselves and be among people who are like them and who understand them and support them.
Oh, I love that you brought this up because I actually want to ask you what you think about this. One of the core questions for me is it possible to have a summer camp like this that is done ethically? Because to your point, the camaraderie and the community is so crucial. And, you know, having a place where kids can try new sports that are intimidating in the outside world, or where they can learn to love movement, where they can learn about nutrition in an actually like practical way. I feel like that type of camp would, first of all, it couldn't be centered around weight loss. I mean, there's just no way that that would ever make sense, you know, and there would have to be a lot of education around the dangers of diets and eating disorders. And there would have to be therapists to help these kids identify their own behaviors. But yeah, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be so tricky to do ethically, to do well, and to do without tipping over into the sort of weight loss, you know, diet culture stuff. So, you know, it's interesting. There was a place called Green Mountain at Fox Run in Vermont that was sort of a camp like this for women, for grownups, that was, you know, centered around body acceptance and giving up dieting and learning to love yourself and learning to, you know, engage in movement in a positive, joyful way and learning nutrition in a way that was like sustaining and, you know, non-diet. And it operated for many years. I think it was like 45 years or so. And, you know, founded by one woman and family run. And a lot of people had great experiences with it. But their marketing was interesting because they had to, you know, I remember seeing discussions in online forums that I was a part of with the, because I believe the owner was a dietitian, and she would talk about like sort of the difficulty of threading this needle of like trying to get people to come to a place like this that who maybe didn't know that what they needed was a non-diet approach, right? Who like did feel dissatisfied with their bodies, who wanted to lose weight. The language they were using was sometimes like something that people in the, you know, anti-diet, weight-inclusive space were sort of critical of, because it would be like, you know, find your healthy weight or something like that, right? And it was like they were trying to appeal to people who still wanted diet culture and were coming out of diet culture, but they were offering something totally different. And I just don't know, you know, it closed. The original owner retired, I believe. And I don't know anything about the behind the scenes. I really don't have any inside information about it. But like, I wonder if something like that for kids could be financially viable or sustainable if they didn't have some sort of diet culture marketing or like diet culture adjacent marketing attached to capture the parents and the kids who, you know, thought that they needed to change their body, right? Like, I just don't know how big of a market there is for something like that, that it would be able to operate totally independently of diet culture, maybe in a small scale, you know, maybe a really small day camp or small sleepaway camp or something like that, but nothing on the scale of what Camp Shane was, because, you know, I just don't know how they keep the volume and like attract the clientele that is going to keep coming back. And then there's also this piece of like, you know, diet culture's business model is so effective and sustaining because it creates repeat customers, right? Like people will go on a diet, lose weight temporarily, almost inevitably gain it all back, and then blame themselves or blame, you know, in some cases, maybe blame the diet in the sense of like, oh, well, maybe this one wasn't right for me, so I need to try another one, or be like, blame themselves and think, I just need to buckle down harder. I just need to have more willpower. My life got in the way, but if I could just get back to, you know, sticking with this. And so I'm going to go on a retreat, or I'm going to do this program for 6 months or whatever, 3 months, and get myself back on track. That's the engine of it. And I definitely heard in your podcast, like some elements of that too, right? That kids were repeat customers of Camp Shane because they would lose weight temporarily, but you know, it wouldn't stay off because that's how bodies are in most cases. They want to get back to where they feel safe. And so then sort of had this built-in repeat customer base because of what it was creating versus a camp that was, you know, a weight-inclusive, body-affirming type of place. There are so many pressures from diet culture and so much going on in the outside world that maybe repeat customers would be there for it because they need a refuge from all that stuff to a point. But maybe at a certain point, once you've internalized it enough, you know, I do know people who've graduated from working with me and just kind of gone on their merry way, and I've stayed in touch with them and they do not backslide. You know, they're like happy in their lives and with their bodies and their relationship with food. And despite all the sort of diet culture pressures around them, they're able to just keep on going because they have experienced the alternative and they don't want to go back there. I wonder if there were enough people who sort of came out of it with that self-love and those skills and that sense of I'm good enough as I am and I don't need anything to feel better about myself. They might not need camp anymore either for that reason.
Right. Yeah, I think it's tricky. I know there are a number of people, of parents and staff from Camp Shane who saw what Camp Shane promised. They experienced the actual terror of Camp Shane and then went on to attempt to open their own camps, you know, thinking like, well, there's still this demand. I want to do it more ethically. But I've just always kind of been like, I mean, as long as there's a scale and as long as there's we're talking about kids, like, I don't know that this is there's a way to do this, you know?
I agree. I think if it involves a scale and intentional weight loss in children, it's not going to be helpful or ethical or, you know, something that's really going to truly help children's well-being over the long term. I think if it, you know, if it were something that was fully weight neutral, weight inclusive, it didn't involve the scale, that wasn't about weigh-ins and things like that, but actually truly about finding peace in your body and well-being for you, whatever that looks like at any size, that's a great idea. But I think still executing it is tricky. Because even with, like, you know, Green Mountain at Fox Run, which their program seemed generally pretty good, even despite the marketing had some diet culture-y flavors. Like, to me, it was the program seemed pretty much in line with weight inclusivity. And yet there were still some things that, like, depending on where you were in your relationship with food and your body, might not have been appropriate. Because if you go to a program for, I don't remember how long it was, a few weeks, whatever, are you really ready to get into the, not necessarily minutia, but like into the weeds of nutrition a little bit without turning it into a diet in your mind? And so, you know, they had like a plate model that was the sort of non-diet plate model that was different from, you know, the government's My Plate, but not entirely, you know,
right. And like, right. Still a plate.
Still a plate. And yeah, still had, you know, sort of ideas about what foods should go where and how much of your menu they should make up and stuff. And I just think, I don't know if you can really jump to that without, or even if some people ever really want that once they have healed their relationship with food, but especially if you're earlier in your stages of healing your relationship with food. And I teach an intuitive eating course. I love the intuitive eating principles, sort of the way they're laid out, where gentle nutrition is the last principle. And it's like that for a reason, because the authors of the original book, Intuitive Eating, who developed the model, found that people really needed to do all this other work, breaking down the diet mentality, getting back in touch with their hunger and fullness, you know, re-experiencing pleasure in food, all of that stuff, before they could ever sort of look at nutrition in a gentle way and not just turn it into another restrictive, depriving sort of diet. I think it would be really tricky to do in practice. I definitely understand the impulse of wanting to create a space like that. Maybe you just create spaces like that that are weight inclusive without having to advertise it as such, and you don't have food as a part of it, really. The food is just good food that kids would enjoy, and people can serve themselves, like, cafeteria style or whatever. And the activities are fun activities that everyone would enjoy, and they have modifications for people of different abilities and sizes and all that. And a place where it's kind of not a thing would also maybe be really beneficial.
Yeah. I know there's, I think it's called Fat Camp. It's like the retreat for, I think it might just be women, adult women. Have you heard of this?
I think so.
And it's just like a
fat positive vacation. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sounds great.
There's Babe Camp, Virgie Tovar's.
Oh, Virgie, of course.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's probably lots of things like this at this point that are, you know, retreats. And I think doing it for adults, it's still difficult, I think, to create a space like that that's going to be, like, inclusive of everyone. And people come with so much trauma and baggage about their bodies, whether they're kids or adults. And, you know, especially I think adults sometimes who've been in diet culture for decades and just have so much to unpack. Like, it's hard to create spaces that are able to hold that. I think eating disorder treatment centers are also imperfect, but one space that can offer some of that, like, therapeutic support. It's tough. I'm curious, like, how you have seen, if you have seen any of those camps for kids open up yet, or if they're just sort of in the works, and what you think about them if you've seen them in existence.
There are a couple that are in operation, but I mean, I haven't been on site. I'm not sure. After this Camp Shane experience, I'm extremely hesitant to review a place without actually having been there, because we know how that goes. So yeah, I know there's a few that are in operation. They're trying, but I can't really speak to how safe or ethical these camps are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good caveat or caution for any parents who might be thinking about sending a kid to a camp like this, right? It's hard to know from the outside whether the marketing matches up with reality.
And in most cases, what these kids need is not related to their weight whatsoever. You know, if you do have a kid that has issues with food, I certainly had issues with food, like I said, growing up. What I needed was a medical diagnosis and I needed therapy. And I got both of those things. I actually did binge eating therapy a few years ago. There was a program through Drexel, and that was tremendously helpful for me. So, you know, if you are one of those parents who really is, your kid is actually struggling in that way, there are a lot of other things outside of fat camp that you can do to help your kid.
Totally. Yeah, the actual therapeutic support they need. I also, you know, had an eating disorder, like have a long ago now history of eating disorder and disordered eating. But I remember at the time, like looking to so many other things than the actual things that helped me, you know, like therapy and intuitive eating and just sort of letting go of the restrictions and stuff. I was looking for like, what diet can I do that's going to solve all these health problems that have suddenly mysteriously cropped up after I started, you know, restricting my diet? And what kind of treatment is going to help me stop the binging, but sort of allow me to keep the restricting, because my disorder was always on the restrict binge side of things. So I'd be restricting and then like binging because of the restriction. And then it would be a vicious cycle, and overexercise was in there as well. And so I was like looking to hold on to the restrictive eating and the extreme exercise and just stop the binging, which I now know is not possible. Certainly wasn't, you know, for me, and is not possible for most people. And so I was like looking to all these different diets and cutting out food. And am I sensitive to this? And can I just do this to get rid of the binging and all of the things that other than what really was the most helpful, which is interesting, right? I think because of our culture's emphasis on weight and how people look and weight loss being such a magic ticket to all the things that you want, the conditioning that we get from diet culture, I think, leads us away from thinking about the deeper roots of things and the treatments that are actually going to be effective. Because I actually was, in the beginning of my eating disorder, I enrolled in a study when I was in college. They were doing a study of an online program that was, you know, so much of what I teach clients now, of like letting go of restriction and making peace with all foods. And it felt like very in line with intuitive eating, actually looking back on it. And there was a lot of body image work as well, and sort of helping people to try to make peace with their bodies. And I remember being in the program and just being like, ugh, this is not for me. I'm never going to like let go like this. How dare you tell me that, you know, I'm not eating enough and that I actually need to eat more. Like, I need to be able to stick to my restricted diet, and I have to figure out, you know, I'm eating too much, quote unquote, because I'm binging. So like, let me figure out how to actually do this. So I had to be ready, I think, for that kind of approach. And when I finally came back around to it, I was like, okay, I can trust and know that this is the right thing for me. And this is actually going to, and so much experience of trying to do it the other way had shown me that none of the restrictive stuff actually worked. And so I was finally willing to give it a try. You know, I don't know how I got on that tangent.
We love a tangent.
I'm curious. I want to hear more about like how you made the podcast. Like, how did you get in touch with all the people that you connected with? And there's just so many interesting people and interesting stories, and the true crime element we haven't even really touched on, of like all the sort of deception that was going on with the management of this camp. And so like, how did you go about making this? And was this like a years long process for you?
Oh, I am happy to answer that question. So I was at Camp Shane in 2011. And the moment I left, I was like, I need to do something about this. Do I go to the police? Do I alert a news station? Do I write a newspaper article? I wasn't totally sure how to go about it at first. My background is in filmmaking. So at the time I was in college in a film program at Ithaca College. And I was like, you know what? I feel like this actually needs to be a documentary. I've got the skills. I'm about to get the degree. Let me go ahead and make this into something. The first couple of years out of Camp Shane, I was kind of toying with the idea of doing this project. But quite frankly, it was kind of that like gaslighty voice in my head that over and over again was like, was it that bad? Did I really experience that? Was it actually a problem? And I would kind of like put it away. And then I'd hear an ad for dieting on the radio, or I would pick up a box of cereal and there was some stupid diet on the back that it was encouraging me to follow. And I'd go back to the project and I'd be like, no, actually, this is really important. I really need to make this. And then I would get overwhelmed because I didn't have the money and I didn't have a camera and I didn't have a crew. And I would put the project away again. And then I would see one of my former campers on Facebook posting about how they were, you know, trying to lose weight. And I would pick up the project again. And this went on and on and on for like 5-6 years. Finally, in probably 2016, I committed. I was like, you know what? This isn't going away. I'm going to make this. And I started just out of my own money from being like a gig worker and a babysitter, started flying around the country and shooting interviews. And I hired a couple of friends on the cheap to help me do some of these interviews, you know, to do sound and camera. And I cut together a sizzle reel and I ended up pitching to, in 2020, I think it was, I pitched to HBO, to Netflix, to Hulu, to Amazon, CNN, everybody under the sun. And no one was interested. I mean, people were interested, they were intrigued, but they weren't interested enough to greenlight the project. So for about 10 years, I did this, the fundraising and the pitching and shooting interviews when I could. And finally, about 2 years ago, I decided to transition into a podcast because that had been suggested to me a couple of times. Podcasts are much less expensive to produce. And it turns out people were much more willing to speak to me when they weren't on camera, which I think a lot of that stems from, you know, the different body issues that were developed and emphasized at Camp Shane. Another part of it, too, is a lot of people that I spoke with were afraid of retaliation from the Yettenbergs. So they were not willing to go on camera or to be photographed, but they were maybe willing to, you know, have their voice recorded and just have it anonymized. So the podcast ended up being the right format for this project. And we spent about 2 years putting together the podcast. And then, you know, we just released it this summer. So it was a decade plus labor of love on my end. And then for the production team that helped with the podcast, it was like a full 2 years overtime every single week trying to get people to do interviews or to corroborate evidence or to pull court documents. I mean, there's just so much that went into this project. And I can't believe it's out now. I mean, here we are.
Yeah, I'm sure that must be wild to have. I also, like, my first book, Anti-Diet, was a 10-year labor of love and also picked it up, put it down, you know, was circling around the idea for a long time, then started the podcast, Food Psych, and worked out a lot of the ideas. And that was what kind of honed it enough that I could pitch it as a cohesive book and make what I made with it. But it was just a wild experience when I held that book in my hand and had the release date and was like, okay, it's in stores now. Like, this thing that I've been working for 10 years is finally here. And what now? Like, it was pretty wild.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I've also held that book in my hand. Aww. So it's pretty cool.
Thank you. Well, I have also binged your entire podcast and loved it. And just, I'm sure we could talk for many more hours about what was left on the cutting room floor and all the things that you, threads you didn't get to pull in it, but it turned out really well and was just fascinating listen from beginning to end. And I felt a lot of feelings, definitely cried and laughed and, you know, all the things. So well done creating something that was both entertaining and also like really meaningful. And just, I think it gets people talking, you know, it's certainly, I was just like itching to talk to you about all of this and been talking about it to my husband, to friends and stuff, just the sort of, it's a wild story. And I think it really says so much about diet culture and its hold on us and why people are willing to put aside so much, like you said, to sort of for this promise of weight loss.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we were really excited to have a narrative way to get all of this information out there. because I think people are much more inclined, especially if they're not already in this space of fat activism or body neutrality, they're much more likely to listen to a true crime podcast and get sucked in that way than they are to, you know, be handed an encyclopedia and like forced to read the history and the science of dieting.
Yeah, I think it's great for intriguing people and making people think about these issues who would not otherwise, you know, think about them. I think there's a lot there also for people who are already into, you know, the anti-diet, weight inclusive, body positive spaces. But I think there it's a good introduction, especially in this age of Ozempic and people being maybe less inclined to question diet culture. It's sort of another window to open for people to start thinking about those issues.
Yeah. And you know what is something I want to say about Ozempic that's so fascinating is obviously on one hand, Ozempic has kicked off this kind of like backwards trajectory in terms of fat liberation. And, you know, of course, we see that everywhere. But what no one is talking about is Ozempic proves that fat people were right the whole time. And it's interesting that it's kind of like destroying this like body positive wave. When really what Ozempic to me says is fat people, they haven't been lazy this whole time. They haven't been unhealthy this whole time. This drug proves that. So I think that that's a really interesting side of the Ozempic craze currently.
It is. It's fascinating. And I think the backlash to it among some MAHA types and others, but I think, you know, we see it. I've been noticing it a lot in the MAHA movement where people who are really wedded to this idea of diet and exercise as the cure-all for everything and that your size says something about you as like a moral being and it's morally wrong to be larger bodied and to not quote-unquote watch what you eat or whatever. I think the backlash there is like, you know, this sort of holding on to the personal responsibility narrative when there is, yeah, this drug that proves, you know, that has so much wrong with it and the side effects and all of the unknowns, I think, are really scary. But I think, and it's, you know, detrimental effect on body liberation and body acceptance and people finding comfort at larger sizes without it. I think it's challenging a lot of people who are trying to do those things and kind of pulling people off the movement. But I also think, yeah, it does show that like it's not about willpower. It's not about personal responsibility. This is an appetite suppressing drug. And so when people go off it, their bodies go back to where they want to be and their appetites sort of are programmed to be, right? Which it is really fascinating the way it's impacted the discourse and
so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, which says a lot about how diet culture never went away, right? It was always here, always with us. Just
it was waiting. Yep.
Took new forms, not even entirely dormant, but you know, just was disguised as wellness. And now it's kind of shaking off that cloak and being like, no, it's actually about thinness after all.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for everything you shared here. This was a fascinating conversation. I love talking with you. Can you tell people where they can find you, learn more about your work, and where they can listen to the podcast?
Yeah, of course. So you can listen to the podcast on any app of your choice. And you can follow us on Instagram at Camp Shame with an M. If you went to Camp Shame, we have a little pinned post there where you can share your story in the comments. We love to have all of those additional stories for people to see. And I make a lot of memes. Nobody appreciates my memes. So go to the Instagram and like a meme for me.
Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes. And yeah, definitely encourage people to check out the podcast. Thank you again, Kelsey. This is great.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So that's our show. Thanks again to our guests for being here. And thanks to you for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to ChristyHarrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production. and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasek for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.